Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1, Act 5. Honor is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism. Worcester and Vernon go to King Henry's camp and rehearse the rebels' complaints. Prince Hal challenges Hotspur to single combat, and King Henry says he'll pardon the rebels and make peace with them if they surrender. Falstaff offers his catechism on the negatory value of chivalric honor. In Act 5, Scene 1, King Henry, in his camp at Shrewsbury, asks Worcester the key question, though with an interesting figure. Will this lord, quote-unquote, move in that obedient orb again, where you did give of fair and natural light, and be no more an exhaled meteor, a prodigy of fear? Act 5, Scene 1, lines 17 through 20. As for Worcester, his claims are grounded in his and his fellow rebels' supposed belief that when Bolingbroke returned early from exile, he only did so to restore good government under Richard II and to demand what was his, the dukedom of Lancaster, from his departed father, John of Gaunt. It is generally credited by historians that Henry Bolingbroke did, in fact, swear an oath to that effect at Doncaster, South Yorkshire, in July 1399. But then, according to Worcester in Shakespeare's play, he forgot all about it when Richard became vulnerable, thanks to his extended military campaign in Ireland. So Henry turned full-scale invader and took the crown. This is hard to believe for the reason stated in the present commentary on Act 4, Scene 3. Henry's actions were openly disobedient, so Richard is hardly likely to have been interested in a rapprochement. That seems especially true when we consider that in Henry Bolingbroke, we are talking about a man who had been among the so-called Lords Appellant, a group of high-ranking noblemen who had given Richard II a great deal of grief from 1387 to 1389. If Worcester and the others are the savvy political operators they consider themselves, would they have failed to perceive the hollowness, or at least the instability, of Henry's promise? Well, Prince Hal offers to settle the ominous dispute by single combat with Hotspur, but this chivalric gesture goes nowhere, and Hal in turn points out that the king's offer of reconciliation with the rebels stands no chance of being accepted. As for Falstaff, he is already sick of the whole affair and complains to the prince, quote-unquote, "I would 'twere bedtime, Hal, and all well." The chilly response from Hal is, quote-unquote, "Why, thou owest God a death." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 125 through 126. This response is followed by Prince Hal's departure, and it inspires Falstaff to utter one of the most famous of his pronouncements, his so-called catechism on the concept of honor. The sum of it is, in Falstaff's view, that honor is no more than, quote-unquote, a word. Act 5, Scene 1, line 133. It's an empty word at that, from his perspective. It conceals an infinity of suffering and death, and offers nothing of lasting value in return. The Jolly Knight, in his lighter moments, stands for what we might call a, quote-unquote, life principle. He's for a life filled with pleasure and free of responsibility. Falstaff's scene-ending observation is, quote-unquote, "Honor is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 138 through 139. The Norton editor's footnote number 2 on page 687 explains that a scutcheon is a, quote-unquote, "heraldic shield exhibited at funerals displaying the deceased person's coat of arms." As such, it's an honorific device that has no power to revivify the individual who has paid the ultimate price to have his or her name associated with it. Falstaff sees no value in that. Shakespeare's play by no means sides with Falstaff in supposing that honor is a hollow emblem or an aristocratic scam, but his anti-heroic view is acknowledged as a counter-narrative to keep the heroics of the history cycle in perspective. It is an ancient view or creed. One has only to think of Homer's Thersites in the Iliad to gauge its impressive pedigree. Falstaff's catechism, as he calls it, lays bare to us the dark underside of his zest for life. Maintaining an unheroic creed is the cost of the pleasures that the wayward knight spends his life seeking. It cannot be the king should keep his word in loving us. Wooster realizes that King Henry will never forgive the elder members of the Percy clan, so he withholds from Hotspur Henry's offer of pardon. Hotspur sends defiance and prepares for battle. In Act 5, Scene 2, Wooster is certain that the king will not stick to his promise of clemency for all of the rebels. He says, quote unquote, "It cannot be the king should keep his word in loving us." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 4 through 5. Hotspur may be forgiven, as he is young, explains Wooster to Vernon, but not his elders, quote unquote. "We did train him on, and his corruption being tamed from us. We, as the spring of all, shall pay for all." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 21 through 23. With this selfish argument, Wooster prevails upon Vernon to withhold from Hotspur this part of the negotiations with King Henry. The news, as Hotspur receives it, is welcome to him, as he is ready and eager to fight. This is especially so because Vernon also relays to him Prince Hal's challenge to single combat. Hotspur is a little piqued by the boyish enthusiasm Vernon displays in relaying that challenge, as if it were his own, but it spurs him on all the same. "Give me life, which if I can save, so. If not, honor comes unlooked for." The Battle of Shrewsbury begins in earnest. Falstaff informs us that he has, quote-unquote, damnably led his infantrymen to their deaths needlessly. Prince Hal requests a sword from him, but gets only a bottle of sack. Falstaff remains unimpressed with martial valor. He chooses live dishonor over an honor-seeking death. In Act 5, Scene 3, Sir Walter Blunt has bravely died in the king's stead, as Douglas, his killer, finds when Hotspur arrives on the scene and recognizes the slain man's face. Sending forth a number of decoy kings was a common mode of deception in medieval warfare, which makes sense because in those times, political leaders tended to spearhead their own military actions, risking their lives along with their troops. While the prince, Hotspur, and many others fight, Falstaff shirks and reflects on the knavery he has practiced. In soliloquy, he offers this stunning, callous confession. Quote unquote, "I have led my ragamuffins where they are peppered. There's not 3 of my 150 left alive, and they are for the town's end to beg during life." Act 5, Scene 3, lines 35 through 37. What a stark summation of the prospects of poor soldiers during the Middle Ages. Sooner than Falstaff could have wished, Prince Hal comes by, asking the devious shirker to lend him a sword. Falstaff is already claiming to have, quote-unquote, paid Percy, Act 5, Scene 3, line 45. But when the request for a weapon comes his way, in lieu of even a pistol, he hands the prince a bottle of sack with the quip, quote-unquote, "There's that will sack a city," Act 5, Scene 3, line 51. Hal is not amused. He throws the bottle at Falstaff and scolds, quote-unquote, "What? Is it a time to jest and dally now?" Act 5, Scene 3, line 52. Hal has had enough of Falstaff's cowardly behavior, but when the prince leaves to rejoin the fighting, Falstaff is nonplussed and declares in soliloquy that he willingly forgoes all opportunities to win, quote-unquote, "such grinning honor as Sir Walter hath." Act 5, Scene 3, lines 55 through 56. His view is that honor sometimes comes to a man in the fury and fog of war. Quote unquote, "Give me life, which, if I can save, so. If not, honor comes unlooked for, and there's an end." Act 5, Scene 3, lines 56 through 57. A man may get some taste of the classical Greek and Roman afterlife, which is glory after death, in spite of his deficiencies. "Think not, Percy, to share with me in glory any more." Prince Hal rescues the king from Douglas and at last encounters Hotspur. Falstaff plays dead to get out of a sword fight with the fierce Douglas. Hal vanquishes Hotspur, then grieves moderately over the supposedly dead Falstaff. Now alone, Falstaff stabs the already dead Hotspur so he can claim the kill. Hal returns with Lord John and agrees to, quote-unquote, grace Falstaff's ridiculous lie. Earlier in the play, Prince Hal had said he would end up, quote-unquote, redeeming time when men think least I will. In Act 5, Scene 4, as we near the end of Henry IV, Part 1, that process begins in earnest. Disdaining help for what was historically a very serious, penetrative wound near the left side of his nose that traveled to the base of his skull, Hal rescues his father from the smoking sword of the rebel Douglas. The quote-unquote time that needs redeeming is not only the prince's unruly past, but his father's usurpation of a kingdom that did not belong to him. King Henry's actions since 1399 have brought his son to this moment. They have led him here to a confused, deadly struggle at Shrewsbury in 1403 against determined foes who mean to end his father's questionable reign. The redemptive answer to this threat is the Prince of Wales himself. Henry's ultimate legitimacy is none other than Hal, who will go on to become King Henry V. His brief reign would bring glory to England against the French at Agincourt in 1415. We learn in this scene that some had said Hal wished his father dead, and now that ugly slander is put to rest. But the prince has more work to do, and he soon finds himself facing his nemesis, Hotspur. Hal is more than ready for this moment, saying, quote-unquote, "Think not, Percy, to share with me in glory any more. Two stars keep not their motion in one sphere." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 62 through 64. The two stars, so-called, do battle, and Hal emerges the winner. Hotspur utters his last words, and Hal finds himself moved to exalt his opponent and bid him an affectionate farewell. Quote unquote, "Adieu, and take thy praise with thee to heaven. Thy ignominy sleep with thee in the grave, but not remembered in thy epitaph." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 98 through 100. Falstaff, in spite of his principles, is also in the thick of battle, and just before the prince kills Hotspur, Falstaff saves his own skin by playing dead when the fierce Douglas challenges him. The knight is offended when Hal notices him and sets him forth as he really is. Quote unquote, "Death hath not struck so fat a deer today, though many dearer in this bloody fray." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 106 through 107. Well, at least he earned a rhyming couplet. It isn't even so much the insult that gets to Falstaff as the certainty that he is dead. To be dead, says he, is to be, quote unquote, a counterfeit. Act 5, Scene 4, line 114. Then comes the immortal line, quote unquote, "The better part of valor is discretion," which sounds like a twisted variation on Aristotle's definition of virtue as the mean between cowardice and foolhardiness. Act 5, Scene 4, lines 117 through 118. Falstaff has developed quite a skill in codifying his own deficiencies into speciously reasonable verbal forms. To make matters still more absurd, the knight decides he might as well claim he killed the already dead Percy, and abuses his corpse by slashing the thigh with his sword. Caught in the act by Lancaster and the prince, Falstaff can only lie through his teeth to the man who actually did kill Hotspur. From this tepid send-off, we sense that Hal is already moving his affections away from his one-time close companion and mentor. Strangely, then, even before he hears the horn blast that signals the enemy's retreat, Hal agrees to go along with Falstaff's ludicrous pretension, saying, quote-unquote, "For my part, if a lie may do thee grace, I'll gild it with the happiest terms I have." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 151 through 152. This indulgence may seem odd when we consider how intently Hal had come to look forward to this defining moment. Killing Hotspur all but completes the redemptive project Hal has promised the king, and the act should be trumpeted across the kingdom, not dissembled to serve a rogue's private interests. Perhaps, it has sometimes been suggested, this moment is a nod on Shakespeare's part to the messiness or fogginess of the chronicles themselves, how difficult it is to know what happened during history's great events. It's also true that now Hal knows within himself what he's made of. And even though a prince is a public figure, perhaps that inner knowledge is most important to him. Hal's actions may also flow from a deep sense of English history with which Shakespeare has endowed him. In any event, Prince Hal seems secure in his triumph now and in his readiness to defend the kingdom. As for Falstaff, when alone, he gives us another of his promises to reform his conduct. Quote unquote, "He that rewards me, God reward him. If I do grow great, I'll grow less, for I'll purge and leave sack and live cleanly, as a nobleman should do." Act 5, Scene 4, lines 156 through 158. We'll believe that when we see it. Rebellion in this land shall lose his sway. The king orders the duplicitous Worcester and Vernon executed, while Prince Hal releases the Scotsman Douglas for his valor. More fighting remains to be done. In Act 5, Scene 5, King Henry sends Worcester and Vernon to their deaths for lying about his offer of clemency. Prince Hal magnanimously pardons Douglas for his valor in battle. There's still more fighting to do before the rebels are entirely vanquished, so Lord John and Westmoreland will go to fight Northumberland and Scrope at York. The king himself, along with Prince Hal, will proceed to Wales, there to face Owen Glendower and the Earl of March. The king says, quote unquote, "Rebellion in this land shall lose his sway, meeting the check of such another day." Act 5, Scene 5, lines 41 through 42. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, October 15th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.